My name's Natalie Minnis, and at the moment I run a Substack called The Purposeful Path. I might be called a serial blogger because I have done several blogs and podcasts in the past. I did the Imagining Freedom podcast during the pandemic, and before that I did a blog called Democracy Isn't Working. I used to be a journalist until I was made redundant in 2009, and after that experience, I decided I didn't want to work 9 to 5 anymore. So I've done various jobs. At the moment, I'm actually a trained therapist. I do hypnotherapy as well as CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And I'm also a mountain leader. So I take people up the mountains. And my last expedition was an overnight expedition to the Cairngorms.
Were you sort of going along the valleys or up on the tops?
Up on the tops, I was on the plateau and down to the valley. So we went up to the plateau, walked along, did 4 mountains, because it was actually the expedition was to do the 6 Cairngorm 4000s. In other words, the 6 mountains, all of a height of at least 4000 feet. So the first day we did 4 of those on the plateau. Then we went down to Carrarabothy to 500 metres, so we dropped about 650 metres because the plateau is at an altitude of about 1150 plus. And we dropped down to about 500, 550, and then we walked up to Ben McDooey and the next day, and then did Cairngorm, and then staggered back to the car park.
Staggered being the opposite word. Now, did you see anything? Was the weather okay?
Yeah, the weather was, the forecast was dreadful, and the first day was quite rainy. It was pretty bad, but it wasn't as bad as we expected. The second day was lovely and sunny. Because the plateau is such a height, I think that's where the danger comes in, because if you're climbing the highest mountain, for example, Ben Nevis, and the forecast is for very strong winds, just as an example, then you know that when you get to the top, you've got to be very careful, but you're only going to be up there for maybe half an hour, then you'll come down. And as soon as you come down from the top, it's fine. But on the Cairngorm Plateau, if strong winds come in, it's very difficult to suddenly drop down. You're kind of trapped up on the plateau. And I think that's why it can be very dangerous in winter when there's very deep snow.
Well, look, I mean, we just had a bunch of deaths, haven't we, in Glencoe?
Yeah, that was a terrible tragedy. Any death is a tragedy, but I think that one in particular, because the guide was very, very well known. I don't know the names of the two people he was with, and I think he was a very capable guide, and I don't think anyone knows what's happened, apart from I think they were roped together. So maybe one of them maybe had an accident. I think usually when people are roped together, you'll have, and they're on a ridge, they'll be on either side of the ridge so that if someone suddenly fell, the other person would act as a sort of counterbalance. And I don't know, the mind boggles at what might have happened. I mean, someone could have had a heart attack, or they might have been struck by a falling rock. But I think considering the number of people that go over that ridge, the Anakigak Ridge, it's one of the narrowest ridges in Britain. But considering the huge number of people that go over it, I don't think there's a high number of accidents. So that was quite unusual and really sad.
Amazing, really. And it could just be that one fell and then took the others with them because they were roped together. Gosh, I mean, horrific. Anyway, look, we're not here to talk about this. This is what you do for entertainment more than anything else, and obviously fitness, isn't it, Natalie?
Just enjoyment, yeah.
And a bit of danger, you know, because like the weather can change on a sixpence. Anyway, look, we've had all these fires over the last couple of weeks in Hawaii, in the island of Maui, which just so happens to be where a lot of rich people live. So I know you visited it, and you've also been looking at some of the coverage.
Yes, yes. I don't actually watch TV, so I only pick these things up when I'm looking at maybe, you know, YouTube or something like that. So I knew that there'd been a terrible tragedy, and every year you hear about wildfires. It's one of these stories that the news seems to be filtering out quite slowly, and it seems that it's, you know, at first we were hearing that maybe 30 people had died, and then it went up, and Now, some people have said it could be even 1,000. I just don't know. I think the official tally was something like 90, but whatever the number, it just sounds horrific. I visited Maui in 1997. I was on a round the world trip, and I actually had a voucher, and I spent that voucher flying to Maui. And it's a lovely place, and people were lovely. So it's just an awful thing to have happened. But there do seem to be a lot of very serious questions over what happened. There is actually a branch of the US Air Force that does deal with direct energy weapons, and there's a website that you can go to. And one of their bases is in Maui. That's just one thing that seems to point to something, the possibility of something quite sinister having happened. And yes, it could have been a natural wildfire, but there are so many questions about this. The first video I saw on it that really made me start to ask questions was by Really Graceful. She posts on YouTube about various sort of conspiracies and mysteries. And she suggested that the local people around this town of Lahaina, which was the one that was affected by this terrible, terrible tragedy, that there had been a lot of people being asked to sell their properties, and the locals had just refused these requests to sell their properties. The land is prime land, it's desired by people with a lot of money. And a lot of people are saying that this might have been a factor in it. You can't say one way or the other. I haven't been out there since the tragedy, but there are some very, very serious issues being raised. And I watched a video last night by Ryan Christian, The Last American Vagabond, and he was interviewing a woman called Shelby Thompson. I've heard about her before because she runs a website called Unjected, aimed at people who haven't had the vaccination. And I think it's quite successful. It started out as a kind of dating website, and now it's just really helping people connect with each other. But she lives in Maui, and her mother was in Lahaina just before the tragedy happened, just before this fire, whether it was a wildfire or whatever it was, started. And she said that it was really difficult. Apparently her mother said that it was really difficult to even get out of the area, that police were directing people all over the place, but not really directing them out of the area. The alarms didn't go off. There were so many strange things about this. And her mother had to struggle to get away, get back home to where she lived, which wasn't in Lahaina. And since then, the other big problem is that people are donating aid, but the aid doesn't seem to be reaching the victims, because no one's really allowed to go into the area. If there is any truth in this direct energy weapon theory, I don't know if you remember that explosion in Tianjin in China in 2015. And that was another very, very strange explosive fire that happened. And no one really gave any direct answers as to what had happened. And I was just looking at the photographs from that this evening, and to my mind, I think there are some similarities.
The context of all of this is that we are most definitely in the Western press getting a massive emphasis on various types of natural or unnatural weather and climate stories. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Every time there's a storm, it's evidence of climate change, etc. So this is the sort of thing that bothers me. Mm-hmm. From a media point of view, is there seems to be almost a kind of sensationalist obsession with the weather, because in the back of it all, there is this whole climate agenda, which is driving much of the fake green policy. You know, the idea mm-hmm. really that everyone has got to pay not only for all the fossil fuels that they use, but also for the fossil fuels used by sort of 20, 30 previous generations in Britain that did the terrible thing of the Industrial Revolution. Well, I mean, none of this really makes sense to me. And so, you know, there seems to be an amplification of these stories wherever they happen in the world. And while very important other stories are being totally ignored, like the assassination of the presidential candidate in Ecuador, you know, and the incarceration of
Imran Khan.
Pakistan, yeah. Yes. You know, these things. You've got a massive Pakistani population in Britain who are fascinated by that, but they're not really that interested in a wildfire going on in some other part of the world. I mean, last year it was Australia.
Thinking that myself for a while, but the over the last few days, the number of deaths seem to have gone up. There is something really serious about this, I think. You hear about wildfires every year in Australia, in parts of America, but 90 people or more being killed in a wildfire seems very unusual.
Well, they were saying that the winds were so high that the fire was moving so fast that people couldn't actually make it to the sea, even though they knew there was a wildfire there, which to me doesn't really sound like a credible story. You know, the idea is, you know, if you could hear and see a fire, I mean, trees spontaneously start burning. It takes a little while for them to catch fire. So you would have most likely have time to get from, you know, into the sea
and
to
the
get
other
away
thing,
from it.
Yes. It's not very far from at the very large harbour, and yet ships were not allowed to rescue the people. Apparently, even people who lived in other islands and offered to sail their ships to try and rescue people who were in the sea were told not to because it was too dangerous.
Well, yeah, but the idea of the police restricting people moving out, I mean, that does sound, you know, very, very suspicious. Anyway... you're also based near Glasgow, and I know, you know, we've had the demise of Nicola Sturgeon, the discrediting of the SNP, and maybe, you know, who knows how things are going to go in the general election in Scotland next year, but the new Human Rights Act is coming along for just Scotland, as I understand it, which I didn't know about.
I think that that England had a separate consultation, so this consultation is for a Human Rights Act for Scotland, and it's open until October, and it sounds wonderful. I mean, who doesn't want human rights or think that human rights are important? And when I started looking through the consultation, I really felt that it was twisting the idea of human rights. It seemed to be putting a lot of focus on the idea of the right to a healthy environment. So that's just one example, but it was really, really reinforcing this idea. And again, everyone wants a healthy environment. It's very important. But is this actually a human right? Surely human rights should be something that people can use really to hold the government to account. The idea of human rights sort of stems back to the French Revolution, or maybe the American Revolution before that. The Declaration of the Rights of Man, the Bill of Rights. And although obviously Americans had slavery at the same time, so their human rights philosophies weren't exactly perfect. But that's really the idea, that it's about people. The first right, I think, in the UK, the UN Declaration of Human Rights was followed the Second World War. And it was about the right to life, the right to religious freedom. That was obviously really important to the Americans. But when you get the right to a healthy environment...
There are some other very important rights in there, like the right to shelter, the right to food, the right to work, all these kinds of things. And many of those have been eroded. And a right, by the way, a right... means it's something you're entitled to without paying for it. You know, if you don't have any money, you still have that right. And so we're moving into a world where the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was put together after World War II, to enshrine in international law the sorts of things that we saw the Nazis getting rid of.
The right to life.
Yeah, the right to life, obviously, that sort of thing. These sorts of things, it seems, are just kind of falling away right now.
Yeah, I don't know that they're falling away. It's just as they're being maybe... I feel as if those basic rights are being used to encourage people to think that this is all a really good thing. But then as you get deeper into this Human Rights Act for Scotland... you come across the minimum core obligations, which really is about the duty holders, the government has to be held to this. And towards the end of this act, it says that it gives a case study of the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And when you get something like that, maybe I would call it maybe a civil right rather than a human right, because it's something that you could have put so many different interpretations on. And there's a whole list of things under this case study, the right to the highest attainable standards of physical and mental health. And one of the categories is immunization against major infectious diseases. And does that mean that everyone has a right to immunization, or does it mean that there's a minimum core obligation to be immunized? I mean, this isn't, it starts getting less and less clear. And I think there's a real danger that human rights could be used actually as a lever of control. This is what concerns me.
Well, this is one thing that was coming out during the pandemic was this whole idea of, well, if you haven't been vaccinated, then you don't have the right to go near people who have.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that could fall under the idea of the right to a healthy environment. And another thing that could fall under that is whether you're allowed to drive your car. They might say that, well, you know, encroaching on people's human rights if you drive a petrol or diesel car, for example. So I just think that and the other thing is that it comes from the UN. It's the UN that has the blueprint for this. And this has been discussed at length and filtered into a document called SNAP2. That's the acronym. Which I hate that acronym as well. It's like snap to it or something. And I think it's well-meaning. I've read through this SNAP2 document and there are many good things in it. For example, it talks about the right to bodily integrity. But there's so many different interpretations. Basic right, human rights are about the right to life, the right to religious freedom, the right to equality, and things that you can't really argue with. And that the government, you can hold the government to account for that. But when it comes to these things like health is one topic or environment, so many different things could be read into that. We've got to be really careful.
Mental health, one person's insanity is another person's wisdom. You know, it really is. And in fact, it's even enshrined in much of the psychiatric literature that there isn't really any actual proper definition of what makes somebody mentally ill. And so, you know, this is beginning to sound a little bit Orwellian, Natalie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I definitely agree about that. You need something that's more detailed. You can't just leave it up to interpretation by the courts. Otherwise, it's I don't know what it would be, maybe a civil right or a type of law. It doesn't mean that, I mean, obviously we do want mental health to be prioritised, but, you know, it's
It's almost undefined. This is the trouble. And of course, it doesn't really matter undefined. If you haven't got anywhere to live and you haven't got any food. You know,
And there's another category, the right to say it's social security. And again, you know, it's fine to have a safety net, but is this a human right? What does it actually mean for people? Is it going to mean the ushering in of a universal basic income? And if so, then what would be the criteria for that? Would you have to be have certain medical treatments in order to receive the universal basic income, for example? There's so many, it just raises a lot of questions. And I just feel that at the moment, I feel personally speaking, my own experience from being made redundant in 2009 is that the social security system seemed to be a kind of lever of control to kind of nudge me towards taking a job that I didn't really want to take. Many people would argue that that's nonsense, but that was my personal experience. And I think I feel that many of these things that are painted in as being beneficial can be twisted and used to control people.
Well, no, definitely. And I think, I mean, you talked about slavery a bit then. I mean, you know, we know, don't we, what's happened in many of the developing countries is that they, IMF since World War II, has slowly, got them into debt slavery. And, of course, there is a kind of debt slavery which is increasing at the moment with the cost of living crisis, as people are absolutely scared of losing their jobs. And then that is a form of slavery. In itself, the idea that you can be a kind of wage slave, and in that you cannot afford to literally, you know, your whole life will fall apart, your kids won't be able to have anywhere to live, they may be taken off you, etc., if you don't keep your job. And there is a kind of financial chains.
Yeah, I think that's imposed, that's tightened by the taxation that people have to pay. I'm not saying that taxation is inherently bad, but I think the people on the lowest earning people, if they're in PAYE schemes, have to pay the highest proportion of tax. And it's a very unfair system. I mean, if you want to reduce your tax bill, it's the best thing is to set yourself up as a limited company. And it's the same with council tax. All of these things, we don't really know what we're paying for. We have to pay them. But we, you know, there's many people that really struggle to do that.
Yeah, well, about cars, though, because, I mean, in Scotland, probably even more than England, people absolutely have become to utterly rely on their cars. In fact, the entire economy revolves around people's ability to get from A to B on their four wheels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you could imagine suddenly all the vehicles in Scotland grinding to a halt simultaneously, well, that means you don't have an economy anymore. Because it's so utterly reliant on cars and lorries, and yet it seems that the poorer people who are doing this, the small medium businesses with old vehicles, this sort of thing, and it may be elderly people on pensions, are all now beginning to be penalised because they've got older, cheaper vehicles. Well, actually, and this is supposed to be a kind of green agenda, and they're being told you're going to have to scrap those old cars. Well, obviously, that's not very green.
No, I mean, there's so many things that are not very green that we're almost being nudged towards. And yeah, cars is one of them. I think it's very difficult for people, for many people, not to use their cars because public transport is incredibly patchy. It works well in some areas, especially in the city centres. Where I'm living, it doesn't work so well. I mean, earlier today I was out and it was really tricky getting home. You know, I had to change trains and things like that. So I managed, but you have to put a lot of time aside if you're going to travel by public transport. I really do make an effort personally not to use my car if I can use public transport, but it's difficult. And here in Scotland, there's a lot of islands. So we've had a lot of problems with the ferries recently. And it's really shocking considering we're one of the, well, the UK used to be one of the leading shipbuilding nations, and especially based in places like Glasgow. Now, the Corran ferry recently in Fort William, and it just ferries between Fort William and Ardgour, and it takes about 10 minutes each way. It's been had a lot of technological problems, and they had to get an engineer from Germany to come in and service it recently, which is really surprising. And apparently, no sooner was it serviced than it broke down again. I just don't know what's going on. I don't understand why.
Well, look, let's rewind a bit to the days when we were a lot younger, Natalie. And I can certainly remember many fewer people. There was nowhere near the reliance on cars that there is now. And that was because the public transport that I grew up with was cheap, very cheap. I mean, we're talking about what was a ticket? A bus ticket would be 2.5p. Yeah. And that's old money, you know. Maybe 3 or 4 pence, and I suppose that's what about 2p in modern money. Mm-hmm. So it was reliable. It came okay. So if it was loads of snow, maybe the bus might be late, but eventually they came. And buses and trains were the way we all got around when we were youngsters. I don't know about you.
Yes, and in fact, I said this at a meeting recently about the ULEZ in Edinburgh, that I grew up in a 20-minute neighbourhood, and it was called the town of East Kilbride. But everything was within 20 minutes, and we didn't need surveillance. That was the thing. We didn't need cameras to make sure that we were going, you know, we were travelling places on a certain day or a certain time. Everything was within 20 minutes. There was a doctor, the doctors, the dentists, the shops, the school. We used to walk to school. Now, I recently tried to change my dentist because I've moved out of the centre of Glasgow and I've been using the same dentist based in Glasgow for a couple of years. It took me a whole day to actually find a dentist. And even that dentist isn't living in the same town where I live now. It is really difficult to find services close to where we live, where people live. And the other thing is that the town where I live in now has a big hill. So it's not that easy. I mean, I do a lot of outdoor exercise, so I can manage getting up the hill on my bike, but not everyone can. These things aren't always taken into account.
No.
But yeah, there was...
The idea of persuade elderly people to cycle around in the pouring rain in the middle of winter just seemed to me it's not farcical, it's actually quite cruel.
Yeah, it is. And I think the other point that you probably wanted to make is that this public transport used to be nationalised, it was subsidised. And I lived in London at the time of the GLC. I just caught the tail end of that. When I moved to London in the 80s, public transport was so cheap. I actually had a car at the time, and I quickly got rid of it because I didn't need it at all. So if public transport works well, people will use it. And I think that's a much better way to move in a green direction than just forcing people. There's another thing that...
It's that the Green Party are not saying any of this, are they?
Oh, goodness. they doorstepped me once, and I had a very polite chat with them, but I told them, I said... It all seems to be helping the corporates. All this, the green agenda seems to be just playing into the hands of the corporates, in my opinion. When it comes to, for example, computer waste, there was an excellent film made, I think, in 2012 called The Light Bulb Conspiracy. I don't know if you've ever watched it. It's only about 45 minutes long. It was released in the cinemas, but you can get it on YouTube now. For a while it was banned because I think it was Apple took them to court. They were talking about computer waste and planned obsolescence. No one seems to talk about that. I'm sure it wasn't an agenda for COP26. And yet many cities are kind of nudging people or really forcing people who drive cars to use their cars, their phones for payment. So you can't... For example, in Ayr, in the city of Ayr, they've changed all the parking meters. They've made them all cashless, and you have to pay either by your phone or in some cases, I think you can pay by... I'm not even sure. I don't even know if you can pay by card. I think you have to use your phone. So I wrote to them. It's not my council, but if I get caught for not having a parking ticket, then I will get fined. So it does apply to me. I said... It's not right that we should be nudged to actually have to buy an expensive device that we have to pay a rental for in order to pay for parking. But they didn't reply.
Well, I mean, it just seems to me nowadays that there is really they're paying lip service to the public. Actually, these decisions are made somewhere far away where our vote is not going to make any difference. But anyway, look, I know on this climate stuff particularly, you were chatting to me about something called the Committee for Climate the Committee on Climate Change, yeah. Which I didn't really even know existed. Now, this is something which is trying to and successfully bringing in policy. It's a government committee, I believe.
I think it's a quangle. I think they advise the government. I came across it in 2021 during the COP26, the environmental conference in Glasgow. And I noticed that this headline on the BBC saying, "Make people fly less, ministers told." And I just found that such a shocking headline. I thought, who are these people that are telling ministers, government ministers, in a so-called democracy, to make people fly less. And that's how I found out about this Committee on Climate Change. It's described as an advisory body. The current head is John Selwyn Gummer. He was a Conservative Party chairman in the 1980s and Secretary of State for the Environment in the 1990s. And the other members include Nick Chater, who's a professor of behavioural science at the Warwick Business School and a member of the Behavioural Insight Team.
We just lost your, for a second there. Who is this second guy?
Yeah, Nick Chater, the professor of behavioural science at the Warwick Business School and a member of the Behavioural Insights Team, the famous nudge unit that was so active during the pandemic.
Oh, God, we have one of these Warwick Business School people at Bilderberg back in May over in Lisbon too. They seem to be a sort of nest of vipers in there.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And I think some of the other members are genuine, but, well, they probably all are genuine, but they're not really kind of grassroots campaigners, environmental campaigners.
So what's the agenda, do you think?
I get the impression that it's quite a corporate type of agenda. It seems that, I'm just looking down the list of members, because there's also Dr. Rebecca Heaton, who had stepped down following questions over her position as senior executive with Drax, which is a large biomass power station. Yeah, so she stepped down from the committee due to a conflict of interest and was appointed as the new director of sustainability for OVO Energy. Piers Forster, who's a professor of physical climate change and director of the Priestley International Centre for Climate at the University of Leeds. And he was principal investigator of the integrated assessment of geoengineering proposals and a trustee of the UK rainforest protection charity, the United Bank of Carbon. And I think people like that are probably think they're doing a lot of good, but it does have a very sort of corporate financial side to it.
You can also guarantee that many of these bodies are funded by, you know, these tax-free foundations such as Carnegie, Rockefeller.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I'm not saying it's those specific ones, but there is a network of tax-free foundations, many of them American, some of them British too, that are effectively running a kind of parallel government.
Yes, yeah, definitely. There's another member of this Committee for Climate Change or on Climate Change is James Ferguson Skia, CBEFRSA, Professor of Sustainable Energy at Imperial College London Centre for Environmental Policy, and a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And he's also served as a non-executive director of BlackRock New Energy Investment Trust, PLC, since 2009. And he is vice president of the Energy Institute and sits on the advisory board of the Scott Institute for the Energy for Energy Innovation at Carnegie Mellon University.
Ah. So I wonder whether many green activists, you know, your XR types, that have any idea that so many policymakers who are connected with these, you know, massive like private equity firms like BlackRock, for example.
Yes, it just seems like a sort of cozy little club, really, who probably all really think they're doing great things for the earth. But it's really about feathering each other's nests, I think. It's keeping that sort of corporate agenda going.
Yeah, it seems quite cliquey, and it seems to have very little to do with, you know, this sort of genuine ideas of having a egalitarian solution. So, in other words, I mean, there always seems to be, as part of all these policies, Natalie, one of the things I've noticed is if you're rich, you get a free pass. So, in other words, if you buy yourself a £50,000-£60,000 brand new Range Rover, then whatever the zone is, you go through free. Whereas if you've got a clapped out Morris Minor, oh, actually they may be free. Actually, classic cars might. But if you've got an old, 1999 Nissan or something, then you're going to be paying. So there is a kind of reverse taxation side to this, which is extremely it's un-Labour, and it's bizarre. It seems bizarre to me. Mostly, these things are being opposed by the Conservatives, even though they're regressive taxes.
Yeah. When you say most things are being opposed by the Conservatives, do you mean the actual actions that are coming from these committees?
What I'm talking about is these various clean air zones around the country, in London, Bristol, certainly, I would imagine. I don't imagine Glasgow is run by the Tories, but, what you've got is the only opposition being a Conservative to...
Yeah, definitely. Regress- yeah. I think it's because a lot of people on the left have just somehow bought that agenda, and I don't know. I don't really understand how it's happened, because I used to be very much very into the sort of woke sort of side of the environmental issue, and it was quite a struggle for me to really open my eyes fully to see what was actually going on, see that this was that it was really playing into the corporate agenda in many ways. So I think the fact that we're being constantly pushed to use our phones to buy more and more expensive computer equipment that uses rare earth materials, rather than to recycle that equipment, rather than to use old computers, for example. We're always being advised to upgrade our digital equipment. And to me, that in itself is so unenvironmental that I just get very cynical about the whole thing.
Okay, Natalie, well, how do people follow your work online? What's the best way?
At the moment, on The Purposeful Path on Substack.
Okay, Natalie Minnis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.